everyone, and welcome to our deep dive all about the crazy challenges of translating the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be looking specifically at Genesis and Ruth today and unpacking a lecture by Dr. George Payton.
A fascinating topic for sure.
He is like a total pro when it comes to Bible translation, so we're in good hands.
Definitely. And, you know, it's kind of wild how much more goes into translating the Bible than just like swapping words.
Right.
It's like we're trying to build a bridge between totally different cultures and time periods.
So true. And sometimes the gaps between those cultures is like, whoa.
Yeah.
For instance, in Genesis 29, we've got that whole saga with Jacob, Rachel, and Leah.
Oh, yeah. Talk about family drama.
Right. And their uncle Laban is not helping things.
Not at all. And, you know, there's this one word in the original Hebrew that always seems to trip up English readers.
You're talking about that part where it says Leah was unloved, right?
Exactly. That's the one.
Dr. Payton's Orma translator actually used the word hated at first.
Wow.
Talk about a strong word.
Yeah. And that's actually the heart of the issue.
Yeah. Okay. I'm listening.
See, both Hebrew and Orma don't have all those like subtle shades of meaning that we have in English.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, between like and love, for example.
Hmm.
Or even between dislike and hate. It's like they're working with a more comparative system.
So not straight up hatred.
Right. It's more like Jacob loved Rachel more in comparison.
Well, wait a minute. That like changes the whole story.
I know, right?
So Jacob didn't actually despise Leah. It's just that his love for Rachel was way stronger.
Exactly. And understanding that comparative angle is huge for getting other parts of the Bible, too.
Okay. For example.
Well, like when it says God loved Jacob but hated Esau.
Okay. Yeah. I remember that.
It's not about God, like, literally hating Esau.
You're blowing my mind right now.
Uh-huh.
Are you saying that tons of people have totally misunderstood these passages because of this tiny language difference?
It's definitely possible.
Wow. That just shows the power of translation.
Absolutely.
It makes you wonder, like, what other cultural things are we missing when we read the Bible?
Now, that is the million-dollar question. And it actually leads us perfectly to our next example from Ruth.
Okay. Hit me with it.
So we've got Naomi, who is a widow, going back to Bethlehem, and she's telling her daughters-in-law to stay in Moab.
Right.
But the reasons she gives sound a bit weird to us today.
Yeah, she even talks about getting remarried and having more sons.
Yeah, it's a head-scratcher. Unless you know about Levirate marriage, which is where Dr. Payton's insights come in handy.
Okay, remind me, what is Levirate marriage again?
So imagine this. A man dies without having kids.
Okay.
His brother would then have to marry the widow.
Really?
It was his duty to take care of her and keep the family line going.
That's intense.
And any sons they had would be considered the dead husband's heirs.
So it was all about keeping the family legacy alive.
Exactly.
So wait, is Naomi basically saying she can't give her daughters-in-law a husband who could do this Levirate marriage thing?
That's exactly what's going on.
Oh, wow. That makes her words so much more heartbreaking.
Right.
She's not just being practical. She's worried about their future.
It's a super poignant moment once you understand the culture behind it.
Levirate marriage was a huge deal back then because women needed male relatives to survive.
It was a completely different world.
It's like we've cracked a code. Naomi's speech goes from confusing to deeply moving.
Sure.
It just shows you how important cultural context is when you're trying to understand these stories.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And speaking of codes to crack, let's talk about the whole redeemer idea in Ruth.
You mean the ghoul?
That's the one. It's a real head-scratcher for modern readers.
I'll say it sounds like a superhero or something.
Uh-huh. Well, in a way, it kind of is.
Oh.
That Hebrew word ghoul has a ton of different meanings, all tied to the idea of restoring and rescuing things.
Okay, lay it on me. What kind of things are we talking about here?
Well, just imagine, like, a family member, a lawyer, and a superhero all rolled into one that's your ghoul.
Whoa. Okay, that's a powerful combo.
Right. So a ghoul could buy back family land that was lost.
Interesting.
Or pay off someone's debts to set them free. Even rescue someone from slavery. They could even step in to protect someone who was being attacked.
So they were like the ultimate fixer.
Pretty much. They're all about setting things right.
Okay, so how does this all connect to Boaz and Ruth?
Well, Naomi sees Boaz, who's a wealthy relative, as someone who could maybe redeem their whole situation.
Yeah, their land was gone and they were really struggling.
Exactly. She was hoping he might buy back the land and maybe even more.
So she was hoping he would be more than just a land buyer.
You got it. And Boaz doesn't disappoint. He totally steps up as a true goel in every sense of the word.
So he's our superhero.
You could say that he becomes Ruth's protector, provides for her, and even considers marrying her to continue the family line.
Now that's what I call going above and beyond.
And this all leads up to that super important scene at the city gate.
Oh, yeah, where Boaz negotiates with the other potential redeemer.
That's the one. It's like a legal drama unfolding right before your eyes.
And it just shows you how important this whole redemption thing was in ancient Israel.
It wasn't just about land or money. It was about keeping families together, honoring obligations, making sure family lines continued. It was baked into their whole social and legal system.
Fascinating. So what happens in this scene?
Well, Boaz very carefully explains the whole situation to the town elders and to this other guy who actually had first dibs according to the law.
Oh, so it was like a legal showdown.
In a way, it was, and it gives you a glimpse into how seriously they took these kinship obligations.
But then there's a twist, right? This other guy backs out.
Yeah, he says he doesn't want to jeopardize his inheritance.
What did he mean by that?
It's a bit cryptic, but scholars think he was worried about having to divide his property among more heirs.
Like any kids that Ruth might have with Boaz.
Exactly. He was trying to protect his own family's financial future.
So even back then, people were thinking about inheritance.
Looks like it. But seriously, it shows that even acts of redemption had real-world consequences.
It makes you think, how often do we just skim over these parts of the Bible without realizing the cultural stuff going on behind the scenes?
It's easy to miss those deeper layers.
We're like missing half the story.
Totally understanding the culture is key to unlocking the true meaning of the Bible.
It's like having a secret decoder ring.
Love it.
Okay, before we wrap up part one of our deep dive, we've got to talk about that Hebrew word, hist.
Oh, yeah, that one is super important.
It's usually translated as kindness,
Yeah.
but Dr. Payton said that doesn't quite cut it.
Not even close.
In part two, we'll unpack what makes hist so much more than just being nice and how it reveals that incredible connection between Ruth and Boaz. Until then, keep those brains buzzing.
Welcome back to our deep dive. You ready to tackle Hesist?
Oh, yeah, I'm all ears. I remember Dr. Payton saying that translating his is just kindness doesn't really do it justice.
No, it really doesn't. It's way more than that. Remember that scene in Ruth chapter 2
Okay.
when Boaz is like super impressed by Ruth and says, "May the Lord under whose wings you've come for refuge bless you and reward you for your hesed."
Yeah, and what's even cooler is that Ruth actually uses that same image of seeking refuge under wings later on.
Right when she asks Boaz to be her redeemer.
It's like they have this secret understanding of haze that goes way beyond just being nice.
It's definitely deeper than that.
Yeah.
It suggests a real connection, a commitment.
So what exactly did Ruth do to earn that kind of praise from Boaz?
Well, first of all, she chose to leave her home and everything she knew behind to stay with Naomi.
Right, even though she didn't have to.
Exactly. And then she goes out and works her tail off, gleaning in the fields to support them both.
That's some serious dedication.
Yeah, it's hard work. But she does it all for Naomi.
So that's where the deeper meaning of haste comes in.
Exactly. It's about that unwavering loyalty, that faithfulness, even self-sacrifice.
Sticking by someone no matter what.
You got it.
I'm starting to think a better translation might be loyalty or faithfulness.
I think those fit really well, especially considering Ruth's decision to stay with Naomi and marry within the family to keep their line going.
It shows a level of commitment that goes way deeper than just a random act of kindness.
Absolutely. Hazzide has that sense of covenant loyalty woven into it, staying true to a relationship even when things get tough.
It's about going the extra mile, putting someone else's needs before your own.
Exactly. And, you know, it makes me think about how our own culture can sometimes make it hard to really understand the Bible.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's easy to read these ancient texts through our modern lens without even realizing it.
We impose our own values and interpretations.
Exactly. It's a trap we can all fall into.
That's why exploring the cultural context is so important.
Absolutely. It helps us peel back those layers and get closer to the original meaning, you know.
To the heart of what the author was actually trying to say.
Precisely.
So Hesiod isn't just some abstract concept. It's like woven into the story.
It drives the characters' actions, their motivations.
I'm definitely going to reread Ruth with this new understanding of Hesiod.
It changes everything, right?
Totally. Okay, let's rewind for a second and talk about that scene where Boaz is negotiating with the other potential redeemer at the city gate.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Remember how he's super specific about the whole thing?
He lays it all out.
He says, "I thought I should disclose it to you so that you could redeem it if you wish.
Yeah.
But if you will not redeem it, then tell me so I will know. For there is no one to redeem it except you, and I am next after you."
What a scene. It's like we're watching an ancient legal drama.
I know, right? You can practically hear the gasps from the crowd gathered at the gate.
Totally. Boaz is like meticulously following the legal rules, making sure everything is done by the book.
And it just shows you how important this whole idea of redemption was to the Israelites.
It wasn't just about land or property.
Right. It was about restoring families.
Honoring those obligations.
Making sure family lines continued.
It was a part of their whole social and legal system.
And you can see how Boaz, by stepping up as the Redeemer, is really embodying his.
Oh, absolutely. He's not just checking off some legal requirement.
Right. He's showing true loyalty, compassion, and commitment to both Ruth and Naomi.
Going above and beyond.
This is a perfect example of how understanding the culture can unlock those seemingly confusing parts of the Bible.
It's like we're getting a peek into a whole other world.
A world with its own unique values, beliefs, and social structures.
And that's what makes studying the Bible so fascinating.
Get a journey.
Uncovering not just the text, but the people, the culture, and the history that shaped it.
You know, this whole discussion about Hesychaz has got me thinking.
What's that?
Do we see this concept in other parts of the Bible?
Oh, absolutely. Heft pops up all over the place.
Really?
It's often used to describe God's relationship with his people.
Interesting. Like where?
Well, you see it in the covenant with Abraham in the Exodus story and in countless other stories of deliverance and restoration.
So it's not just a one-off idea.
Nope. It's a core principle that runs through the entire biblical narrative.
It connects us back to that ancient world.
And to the God who embodies it.
That's a powerful takeaway.
It really is. It reminds us that these ancient texts aren't just stories. They're full of truths and principles that still matter today.
But we have to be willing to step outside our own cultural bubble to really understand them.
To embrace the richness and complexity of the world they came from.
Well said. Okay, as we wrap up part two, I have a question for you.
Shoot.
Think about a time when you totally misunderstood someone because of a cultural difference.
Oh, I've had plenty of those.
Maybe a gesture was misinterpreted or a word meant something different than you thought.
Happens all the time.
It's a good reminder that communicating well takes empathy, understanding, and a willingness to learn from each other.
Couldn't agree more.
Now imagine trying to understand a book written thousands of years ago in a completely different culture.
It's like trying to solve a puzzle without all the pieces.
That's where deep dives like this come in.
They help bridge that cultural gap.
And unlock those hidden treasures in the text. You know, it's amazing how just a little bit of cultural understanding can completely change how you read a story.
It really is.
It's like those 3D pictures where you have to kind of like blur your vision.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
And then suddenly, boom, a whole other dimension pops out.
Uh-huh. I love that analogy. It's so true. We often read the Bible with our modern 21st century glasses on.
But to really get it.
We need to try on those ancient lenses.
You know, it makes me wonder, if we were translating the Bible today, how would we handle these cultural challenges?
That's a great question.
Like, how would we make it clearer for modern readers?
Well, maybe we could add more footnotes explaining those tricky cultural bits.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Or even create some dynamic translations that focus more on the meaning.
Rather than just being word-for-word literal.
Exactly.
Like adding subtitles for the soul, right?
I like that.
Bringing those ancient voices to life in a way that really speaks to us today.
Because the Bible might have been written ages ago, but still has so much to teach us.
Totally.
But to hear its message, we need to listen with those ancient echoes in mind.
So well said. This whole deep dive has been eye-opening.
It has.
I bet our listeners feel the same way.
I suppose so.
We've explored those cultural complexities in Genesis and Ruth from those tricky translations of love and hate.
Right.
To that mind-blowing concept of Hesed, who knew one little word could be so packed with meaning.
It's incredible. And, you know, we've only just scratched the surface.
There's so much more to discover.
A whole universe of cultural insights just waiting in those pages.
Okay. As we wrap up our deep dive, I want to leave you with one final thought.
Okay, I'm listening.
It's inspired by Dr. Payton's lecture. So, think about this. How does language and the culture it reflects shape your own understanding of the world around you? I don't just mean the world of the Bible. I mean your everyday experiences.
Yeah.
The way you interact with people. Even how you see yourself.
It's definitely something to think about.
Because just like those ancient Israelites, we're all shaped by our time and place.
But by recognizing those influences,
we can start to see the world and each other with more clarity and compassion.
That's a great takeaway.
And that, my friends, is the power of a truly deep dive. So keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep those deep diving minds engaged.